This is J. Terry Iverson, the Academic Coordinator for Extension and International Affairs at the University of Illinois. The tape that you are about to hear is that of a keynote address delivered by the Honorable Gail W. McGee, United States Senator from Wyoming, and a member of the prestigious Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senator McGee's address, entitled The Limits and Responsibilities of Dissent, was delivered on Saturday, March 1, 1969, in Springfield, Illinois, at the World Affairs Conference of Central Illinois. The title of the conference, or the topic for the conference, was New Politics, Dissent and Violence, International Phenomena. The keynote speaker the previous evening was the Reverend Jesse L. Jackson, who spoke on the Black Revolution and New Politics. Senator McGee on Saturday was introduced by Mr. Raymond Dooley, the president of Lincoln College. Unfortunately, Mr. Dooley's remarks did not record, and therefore I am obliged to read the introduction for Senator McGee so as to give you some biographical information on this distinguished speaker. Our keynote speaker today brings with him the experience and background of a scholar and a statesman. After receiving his Ph.D. degree in history from the University of Chicago, he distinguished himself as a professor of history at the University of Wyoming, where he was to help found the Institute of International Affairs. His teaching has never been restricted to the college campus. Prior to his election to the United States Senate in 1958, he was a professional lecturer on the subject of American traditions and U.S. foreign policy. Since his election, he has accepted well over 300 speaking engagements. Many of you here will recall that the senator delivered the keynote address at the World Affairs Conference in Dixon, Sterling, Illinois, last year. The subject of his remarks at that conference was the title of his most recent book, entitled The Responsibilities of World Power, which was published by the National Press Company in 1968. As a member of the United States Senate, he is highly regarded as one of its most articulate spokesmen in public and world affairs. At the present time, he serves on a powerful Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the Appropriations Committee, and the Banking and Currency Committee. He is chairman of the Post Office Committee. He is also a member of the United States Commission to UNESCO, a special committee on water resources, and the National Food Marketing Commission. His continuing interest in foreign affairs has been augmented by his many visits to foreign countries. He has directed study tours to 8 Western European countries and to the Soviet Union and its Eastern European allies. In recent years, he has traveled throughout Asia to acquire insights into the war in Vietnam. As a leader of his political party, the senator was the chairman of the Wyoming delegation to the Democratic Convention held in Chicago last August. On several occasions, during and after the convention, he was interviewed on national television concerning his opinions of the disturbances in Chicago and the news coverage of the convention as a whole. The topic of Senator McGee's address is The Limits and Responsibilities of Dissent. Senator Gail W. McGee.
Not only a pleasure to be here, but to see a sprinkling of Wyoming infiltrators scattered about from all levels. Former students, former professors, former state administrators of all sorts. We used to worry because in our summer schools at the University of Wyoming, we have more, the largest outstate enrollment is from Illinois. people out west always marvel at that. That's because they've never spent summer in Chicago like I used to spend it for a great many summers when we were torturing through that process. But we're glad that we're working back the other way, too. We were talking a bit beforehand in a little informal chatting about the seniority system and the ailments of the Congress in these times, and I thought you might be interested in a story that Terry's heard me tell many times, but it's a true story. It's footnote to this question. It has a little bit to do with why I took a chance on getting where I am, and it has to do with seniority, and that goes back to Chicago. When I was a graduate student up there, I used to get fed up very quickly with the attitude toward graduate students. We were just the lowest of peasants. The assistant professors would have very little to do with us. And of course, they were isolated by the associate professors. They were isolated by the full professors, who were beholden to no one except Chancellor in those days, Robert Maynard Hutchins. And he would have nothing to do with anyone. But he was a very stimulating fellow, and so I was determined on leaving Chicago that whatever else, I would devote my life to overcoming that lowliness, to overcoming the handicap of academic seniority or its lack. And I worked at it very hard. I got enough jobs and taught at enough different places and hung on long enough that some of my colleagues themselves found better jobs. Some of them retired, and I ultimately, through sheer survival, became a full professor, where I didn't have to bow my head and look downward in shame at my lowly position. It was only then that I made a rather shaky discovery. That is, that while I had busied myself all those years with reaching the top and becoming a full professor, I discovered that didn't amount to anything. That I was already surrounded by deans and presidents and chancellors and so on down the line. A completely new realm outside professoring had emerged. We call it administration on the campus. And that's when I decided that those many years of academic frustration perhaps should impel me into some other kind of pursuit where seniority didn't play such a role. And look where I ended up. The Senate of the United States, where there is no such thing in its history as two equal persons. It's impossible. Everybody is above or below somebody else. When I came in 1958, and the political science students in particular will be at least have a passing interest in this, but when I came in 1958, that was the largest single class of senators in modern history. There were 18 of us in that class, including both parties. Now in the Senate, if you could ever make a case for equality, it was there. We were all elected at the same election on the same date. It was computed. We were brought in the same moment in political history. Absolute equality, except in the Senate. They had a way to break us up. How they broke us up into our proper role down the scale is what's revealing. First of all, in the Senate, the priority goes to former members of the House of Representatives. Well, among our 18, there were 9 former members of the House. And their seniority is determined in the order of the number of days they were in the House of Representatives. So they get them on the ladder first. And then the second order of priority goes to all former governors of states and statewide elected officials. Well, that took care of another 5. Of our class. But that left 4 of us unanointed and unassigned and unadorned. And it was then, in all of your nakedness, you discover that former professors don't even have brownie points to their credit. But how were they going to break up the four of us who were left? They went back 100 years to find a tradition that was created by Martin Van Buren when he was president in 1857. Two senators came in that year with identical credentials, but they couldn't let them be equal. And so they determined their seniority in the order in which your state had been admitted to the Union. Well, not very many pilgrims landed on the shores of old Wyoming, eh? But there were still two of us tied. That eliminated two more, but two of us were tied. We were from states that were admitted to the Union by the same act of Congress in 1890. And to bust that one, they had to go back 10 more years to the administration of James K. Polk, 1845, where two senators arrived with identical credentials. To break that tie, they determined their seniority in the alphabetical order of states. Well, you're looking at old 98 in those days, you know. It was clearly the end of the line. That's, again, historical students, research students, often study the votes of senators and why, what great motivation lay behind their voting aye or nay, and trying to analyze the other forces that contributed to that decision. And I'm sure a lot of that will go on in regard to the admission of Hawaii to statehood. But you'll discover that Gail McGee from Wyoming was one of the leaders way out front admitting Hawaii as a new state, because in so doing there would be two new senators beneath McGee. That is that's a totally accurate story about how the seniority process is determined in the Senate. I hasten to add, as of recent days, the longer you are around there, the less critical you become of it. It seems to acquire some attributes of wisdom and justice and statesmanship that you didn't appreciate when you first came into the Senate. And even after only 10 years. The fortunes of change are beginning to surface. But I'm here not to talk about the structures of government or the vagaries of seniority, but to visit with you a little bit, and informally, I trust, about this central concern of this conference, the new politics and dissent, its responsibilities and its limitations. I think that what one ought to understand at the outset about the new politics of our time is that it has turned up with some of the strangest allies that one could have imagined. The new left and the old right are locked arm in arm. They're marching in cadence. Each is determined to close down most public institutions. They distrust them for whatever reasons. The new left does it by assaulting them directly. The old right has tried for years to do it by simply cutting off the money. But they have discovered a common denominator of total objective, even though they proceed in opposite directions to achieve it. This is one of the paradoxes of a time that I'm sure proved disturbing to many who seek some kind of rational or orderly analysis of the events around us. And anyone who tries to look back only to a year ago today, March 1st, 1968, and supply a rational explanation of the last 12 months will find himself in a frustrating experience. Well, remember, a year ago today, it was before New Hampshire. It was before March 31st. It was before the April assassination. It was before the June assassination. It was before Chicago. It was before everything else. And whatever else the past year ought to have taught us, it should certainly have sobered us in terms of either being complacent or totally convinced that we know what lies ahead. It urges upon us the imperative requirement that tolerance and understanding and a willingness to listen to the other side or the other sides must never, never be suspended. This is not an American phenomenon, I hasten to add. For the aspirations that we sense in our midst, the dreams that we see coming true all around us, dreams of another day, are very similar to the same dreams held by Czechs or Russians or Chinese or Cubans or North or South Vietnamese. We're not unique in this restless interval that to us seems to be so disturbing at the moment. I just came back a few days ago from London. We had a most fascinating hair-down session out at an old manor there out near Oxford called Ditchley. There they assembled a group of American congressmen, senators, and some distinguished Britishers of various stripes, and as many of the key student leaders in England as weren't involved in closing down the London School of Economics at that particular moment. And we sat around tables till 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, wrestling with the kinds of disturbing questions and that were common to all of us, and groping for some sort of denominator that would enable us at least to communicate. And one of the things that emerged from those little sessions was a reminder to all of us that this is where we came in. Again and again, a former British Prime Minister, a distinguished historian like Arnold Toynbee, or a distinguished former diplomat like George Kennan, or members of the British Foreign Office, or members of the British government at the present time, would stand and say, well, this reminds me of those young upstarts umpteen million years ago. He said, if one of them mentioned, if you'd look on the front page of the London papers in 1935, you would find a group of disheveled, dirty young guys from Cambridge who were out to bring down Parliament, Westminster Abbey, and the world if they could. And the guy holding up the banner was this very sober, gray-haired member of the Foreign Office sitting around the table there. They were simply saying to the young militants who were there that all of us have been militants at some time, that this is not a new phenomenon. This was not just invented by the present college generation. But that doesn't say quite enough. It doesn't say quite enough. There are some differences, in my judgment, with the militant inspiration or the militant motivation of 1969 that sets it a little bit apart from the militancy of my own generation when we were organizing the Abraham Lincoln Brigades and we were going to bring changes all over the world, get rid of the dictators and the fascists in particular, and get in those liberal Democrats that they called communists over in Moscow. This was the language we were using. But there is a difference. One of the differences is that we have in 69 a campus generation that, in my opinion, puts in the shade my generation at that same stage. A generation that is so much better informed, so much better equipped to become actively involved in the machinations of opinion making, of decision making, of understanding that the world in truth is round, and that somehow we're groping for a way in which to survive it all. I often say that whenever members of my radical gang got frustrated, they'd go up and sit on top of a flagpole, or they'd swallow live goldfish just to keep from becoming frustrated. And the world survived us. Maybe not so hot, but they survived us. And the world will survive this generation much better than it survived ours. This is a new ingredient, a capability, a driving interest and concern, and the educational equipment to participate, such as we've never known before in any generation at this stage. A second element separates this generation and this explosive moment from those that have gone before. And that's in the realm of technology. Modern science and technology and our inventive genius have brought into fact the dreams that many thought were hundreds of years away, just a few years ago. The impossible dream, if you wish to steal the phrase from the man from the mansion. The impossible dreams have become possibilities and actualities. This in itself has triggered a new sense of urgency and impatience. A real questioning of, if we can have this, why can't we do more? And that whole atmosphere has sharpened the expectation of many. A third attribute that changes the present from the preceding liberal movements or militant movements of the past is this whole sense of great expectations that engulfs the globe. Not just Western civilization, but the globe. A set of expectations triggered largely by the contacts of World War II, where many hundreds of millions of people for the first time came in direct contact with entirely new national groups, new cultures, and saw for the first time the new breakthroughs and even those technical advances of a quarter of a century ago. And thus a complacent Asia that for the most part had slept at least under a matronly colonial structure, discovered in the throes of World War II what they had a right to expect in their time. And it fired up in many of their breasts the insistence that they have a share of the fruits of God's earth. And further, they resolved to make up for lost time by taking every shortcut they could invent to achieve those objectives. The last of these, or the fourth of these circumstances, and the last one I'll take time to mention, that makes this different than ever before, is the particular phenomenon that we call TV. Or you can call it Cronkite News, if you wish. Whatever phrase you prefer, instant communication. And I separate TV from the newspaper press, from the radio media, because I think Marshall McLuhan's right. It's an entirely fantastic new phenomena, the impact of which, the dimensions of which, we still do not fully understand. It's this media that has made everybody's private backyard somebody else's front porch. It has meant that everything that we do on a very local basis at once becomes the living room gossip 10,000 miles away. It's no longer possible, my friends, to isolate a problem in the neighborhood. It's no longer possible to pretend that somebody doesn't live over there, because they're going to be coming right out at you on the screen tonight. What this says is that the whole tempo of it all has been stepped up, that the whole sweep of it all has been intertwined with everybody's interests, ambitious goals, dreams, selfishness, and limitations. And that what used to be simple problems that you could resolve by saying it's black or white, right or wrong, true or false, good or bad, have become, in the wake of this change, so complex that it's mostly impossible to draw a certain line separating the good guys from the bad guys, unless one closes his mind to the facts of modern life. When you add to this phenomena the dimension of Telstar, and what is approaching a worldwide network of projection capabilities, it becomes almost frightening. But this, again, is a harsh fact of our time. And so it's this setting into which we ought to address our thoughts, this backdrop against which we have to measure our personal judgments in regard to what's going on around us. Now, these new hopes, these great expectations, these frustrated dreams of a better tomorrow are also cast against quite a different world community. And this is what we find sometimes the most difficult in accommodating ourselves to the facts of life around us. By that I mean this, that whereas we've scored these great breakthroughs in standards of living, in resource mobilization, in medical science, in technology, in computerized everything, we still are struggling along in a world that, from the standpoint of international infrastructures, is pretty much as primitive as it was when Hitler was on the rampage, or as it was when Bill the Kaiser was on the loose in Western Europe, or when Napoleon Bonaparte was preying on the continent. It simply says that with these new hopes and these new aspirations, the average person who believes he has a right to change and to expect something greater is caught up in the throes of a world without law, of a world without order, of a world even without organization. It's a jungle world. And it's a sorry commentary on civilized man to remind ourselves of it, but the only substitute for war that man has yet come up with is the balance of power. Balance of power. And it's this clash between what one has been able to arrive at in a local way and what one is confronted with in an international way that perhaps does the most violence to rationale, to equanimity and judgment, and to the harnessing of expectations. This, in truth, comes closest to being the nub of a lot of our current difficulties. It simply means that we're fighting, on one hand, the very rapid momentum of progress, almost as it flies in the face of the lethargy of international organization. It means that we have to begin where we are. And where we are at the one level is at a far different altitude than where we are at the other. You can't pretend it isn't so, or you're in deep trouble. You can't ignore that gap, or you only compound the mess. The late Adlai Stevenson, I think, gave us an excellent word of counsel in that regard. When, while he was our ambassador at the United Nations, he said, "It's imperative that we not forfeit our chance to move ahead in the science of living together as nations. And if we're to do that," he added, "we have to start where we are, not where we might have been, not where we should have been, and certainly not where we someday hope to be, but where we are." And that's the toughest ingredient for many of our people today to accept into their formula for the new tomorrow. Starting where we are. And this is the reason, I think, for the sharpness and the harshness and the all-pervasiveness and the extremes of much of the violence that is both here and in many other parts of the world. It requires that through it all, we recapture a sense of history in order to recover a sense of perspective. Something that continuously seems to escape Walter Cronkite or Huntley Brinkley or anyone else who can solve the world's problems in 3 or 4 minutes because they have to beat somebody else on the air and they have to reduce it to a few words. Perhaps the greatest single casualty of instant communication has been perspective, the sense of history. Now, to be sure, the older one gets, perhaps he falls back upon history too much. We talk about the generation gap. Some suggest that the older generation dotes too much on the history of the past and the mistakes of the past, and they're trying to correct those mistakes. But if that be the case, I submit that probably one of the shortcomings of the younger militants is that they see only the promise of the tomorrows without covering the intervening space from where they are to where they hope to be. The distinguished American historian Edward Cheney at one time noted that not all of history is worth preserving. Some of it had best be forgotten. But in the history of the human race, he reminded us, there is what we call the usable past. It's a selective operation to judge what is usable from the past. Carl Becker, the American historian, one time at Cornell, used to put the point another way when he talked about facts. He said, there are facts all over the place. The problem is not collecting facts. And as TV proves to us today, we're inundated by facts. We're dying of indigestion because of too many facts. We're just loaded with facts. That's one of the reasons for the confusion. The problem is to select the relevant facts. As Becker cautioned his students, facts are cold statistics. They're impersonal. They do not speak for themselves. They have to be spoken for. And who speaks for them? With what competence? Exercising what elements of judgment determines decision-making and the direction of events in our time? And so this is the reason it has become so exceedingly difficult to choose up sides with definitive judgment in most of the issues of our time. And it's in this context that we examine particularly the student movements in the country right now, the campus revolt, if you will. Someone has described the generation gap in these terms. The younger generation is deeply concerned about the prospects of nuclear war. The older generation is deeply concerned and worried about the younger generation. And that's why they often aren't talking the same language. That's why they don't communicate. And I think there's something there. Sometimes we get so obsessed about, in quote, what the kids are up to, that we forget about the issues that really trigger it. And I would be the first to say that there are deep and legitimate and abiding grievances on the campus that should have been surfaced long ago. Like Topsy, our higher educational structures have just grown in many cases. And when they weren't growing, they were just exploding. An illustration. Particularly our older, I suppose you'd say more venerable universities in the East, are the victims of their age. When the university was founded in America, copying their European counterparts, they were accepting young students like John Quincy Adams, who was 12 years old when he entered the university. And the university was a babysitter for immature lads. And many of those universities were still trying to babysit very mature and very sophisticated young people in the 1960s. They hadn't modernized their outlook, their approach, their direction, their mechanism of responsibility. And you find the phenomena of numbers at the university level, the college level, where the fantastic growth from a little under 2 million students just a few years ago to over 8 million students today, and the frantic struggling to build enough buildings, to stack up enough bricks, to find enough teachers to cover the explosion. The result is that the tendency has been steadily in the direction of computerizing the educational experience rather than humanizing it. That the student has become a statistic rather than a boy on the end of the other end of a log opposite his teacher, as Mark Hopkins once described it. We've lost sight of some of the real needed drive in education. And there's always the matter of professors and teaching on the campus. We had an old cliche we used to use sometimes. I'm product of a teacher's college. Those who can, do. Those who can't, teach. Those who can't teach, teach in colleges. We used to poke that little fun at ourselves. But there's more truth to it than meets the smile. We still find the prestige schools establishing their prestige on how many books have you written? How many monographs have you penciled? How many scholarly performances have you contributed in some prestigious forum with almost no credits for the poor soul that might have just been the most exciting teacher in modern times? And it hasn't changed very much And the kids who now know what they have a right to expect in the quest for education don't like it. So I mention these simple illustrations as a reminder that there is real reason and legitimate reason for the campus explosion. But having said that, I want to take a very hard look at the nature of this campus explosion and its implications, its consequences. I've been on now 207 college campuses in the last 3 years, a little over 3 years now. And I can say without a single exception, and that includes Berkeley, where I was about a year ago now, receive an honorary LSD. And they, that on those 207 campuses, it was run the gamut across the country in all directions. Large, small, liberal, conservative, north, south, east, and west. At the great cross-section of those who express themselves, who indulge, are as sober and sobering and inquiring and penetrating a group as I think you'll find anywhere. Anywhere. They're asking the tough questions, the rough questions, but the right questions. And they don't want any pablum in the responses. I think this has a great deal to do with what's happening. They've been fed up with platitudes about democracy and freedom and liberty and all that sort of thing that have become cliches to gloss over the lack of direct responses. They're only asking that you level with them. Straight out. That's what they seek, in my judgment. And they deserve it. But in the process, the campus protest has fallen into the hands in limited areas of extremist groups. Now, let me make clear the extremist group. It's the group that determines that this protest is not to get the acceptance of a bill of goods, not to arrive at compromise, but simply to bring down. Tom Hayden was asked last fall, Tom, what the program was for the new left, his group. And he said, we don't have a program. We only seek to launch a revolution. And once we revolt, there'll be plenty of time to find out what for. Well, that's a cute way of putting it. But unfortunately, that cute phraseology has found its exemplification in too many spots. One of the leaders at Columbia made a great point of the fact that no, indeed, we don't have enough membership in our present movement to bring down the government of the United States, but we're going to. Well, that's pretty hollow stuff. Except that it happens to be the fixation of a few. One of the leaders, I was out in San Francisco, one of the leaders at San Francisco State said the Bible teaches us that there is a time for everything. Everything. And he says, this is a time to hate. hate. It's a consequence of the extremes. The extremists. We've had some very sobering developments. One is that it has tended to surface and strengthen the extremists of the far right. The newer, more conservative mood in this country today is in no small measure a reflection of the extremism of those who are involved at the present time. And to that extent, it jeopardizes the cause of dissent. It jeopardizes the right to think otherwise. It places in jeopardy the healthiness of holding the unorthodox view, or even the crackpot position, if you will. This is reflected on many levels, not the least of which is the Congress of the United States. One member of the Senate not long ago was moved to remind his colleagues that the little red schoolhouse was redder than you think. Another congressman who ought to know better proposed that any professor that became critical of the government of the United States ought to be denied any federal scholarships or research grants anywhere. On the state level, one state government proposed to fire one of its state university employees because he said Hanoi was better than the United States. Well, that's a wild and reckless statement. But he has a right to say it, in my opinion. I think it shows pretty unstable judgment, but that's my opinion. I have a right to mine, too. But he should not be penalized for his statement. Another state legislature in the South reenacted an old law that would bar from the campus any controversial speaker. Now, that didn't mean George Wallace. That meant any speaker that was suspected of being a member of the Americans for Democratic Action, or the Communist Party, or Cope. These were the dangerous, controversial speakers. The moment you try to keep off a campus any speaker, at that moment you're eroding, you're infringing upon what ought to be a sacred, sacred right. And that is the right to hear, if nothing else. The right to be exposed. Because you're not going to be babysat all your life. Somebody cannot look over you and protect you from all these evil ideas. The only way is to fight ideas with better ideas. You can't legislate an idea out of existence. And yet this is the direction we're beginning to move. On the private level, patriotic organizations, veterans organizations, I guess make them synonymous sometime, are demanding the barring of communists from any public campus as a speaker. To me, that's utterly ridiculous. And of course, in the new left, a communist is a member of the establishment. I mean, these aren't, they don't have new ideas. That's the establishment. They're against them, too. But lest we forget, so was Mr. Hitler. And the excesses of the extreme surfacing, this new, very extremely conservative response, remind us of the parallel with Adolf Hitler. That's how he came in. And that's when he came in. When the extremes of the far left finally went to open riots and the destruction of life. And Hitler came in under one banner: law and order. Law and order. Don't forget that. That's why I submit that one of the very frightening and dangerous consequences of the irresponsible left, as I call it, is to strengthen the case for the irresponsible right. A second consequence has been the tendency to inhibit the genuine and sincere dissenter and protester. The extreme, well, let me give you an illustration. I was on a campus the other day where they had a big student meeting, happened to be called by the SDS in that particular instance, could well been some other group. And they had some national officers of the group in that advocated that they put together Molotov cocktails. This was just before the election. And they get down to every polling place and drop one in there when election day dawned. The result was that nearly 250 of these kids who were genuine dissenters and paid their dues in the SDS quit. They walked out. They got burned. And they have tragically shut up since. What I'm saying is that the great danger is that we may snuff out dissent. And you do that, you have a dead campus. You erode your academic atmosphere that requires inquiry and disagreement. The thinking of something other than the conventional, that which is popular in the community. Further casualty of the extremes has been the extreme consequence in the academic atmosphere in another way. The tendency on the part of many in the new left to commit the same crimes against which they were addressing their efforts. The crime of intemperance and disallowance, of closing the mind, of tuning out. Of being so certain that there's only one truth that they become intolerant of the other point of view. And I don't know of any profession, unless it's the medical profession, of where this has become a more conspicuous trait than among professors, some professors. I suppose I've had more totally intolerant letters and intemperate letters and vitriolic letters and obscene letters from academics, or at least quasi-academics, and from any other single group in these times. That's a sorry commentary on the academic mind to begin with, that ever is closed, ever is closed. I talked to a group 2 days ago, a disarmament group. I happen to belong to a lot of those groups, including World Peace Through World Law, One World, World Federalists, all of them. But I don't think they have a chance until we can travel the intervening space to their goals. I think that's the ultimate solution. But in talking to this group on disarmament, the question, of course, that was pending was the currently hot one in Washington, the ABM. And I discovered that they weren't there to talk about the ABM. They were there to talk about how they were going to change the mind of some senators or congressmen about where they stood on ABM. They spent so much time talking to each other for the last several months to begin with, these members of this convention, that they had frozen their minds. And I was disturbed by a New York Times article 2 days ago that reports to have taken a survey of the Senate of the United States and found that 53 senators said the issue's now closed, that there's no case for an ABM. Well, I think most of us kind of lean in that direction as we speculate. But for any senator to say his mind's closed on that before we've even begun our hearings on it, our study of it, the picking of the brains in regard to it, is a sorry reflection of some senators, on some senators. I think we have a great deal more to learn first. Much more we need to know. And it's a sorry commentary on the times to think there are those who, like a blotter, would lap up what may be the passing opinion, let's say, in one of their sections, but may have little to do with the wisest solution to the problem. It's this tendency to close the mind, to freeze out inquiry prematurely. That is a very severe casualty of the time. And therefore, I plead with you, as we examine here in your sessions the question of dissent, that we protect the dissenters, that we respect dissent, but that we urge that it not lose its sight by becoming blind, that it not close the avenues of communication, that it not shut out the forums of debate and disagreement. Someone asked me in our preliminaries before we came in here, what about the violence of dissent? Is there a place for violence? Well, I say that's up to an individual's philosophy. There was a place for violence. Thomas Jefferson found a place for it. Sam Adams found a place for it. Where you have to break a law in order to right a wrong as you see it. The name of the game in civilization is orderly change. We're a nation of laws, not of men, as we mentioned at the beginning. And respect for orderly change is of great importance. But it's conceivable in any ever so many levels that you reach the point in your mind where the violation of the law is the only way out. Well, I say, if or when that moment comes in your judgment, then it's up to you to be prepared to take the consequences. That also is the name of the game. We have too many crybabies. We have too many people who want everything and try to pretend they're living in an unreal situation. John Adams was ready to take the consequences. He said he'd be the first one to be hanged. And he was prepared. Mahatma Gandhi was prepared to take the consequences when they decided that violence, or the nonviolent approach, but breaking the law, was the only way to produce change. And he didn't holler for help. I'm only saying that this street runs two ways as we pursue the right to protest, and that the society of which we are a part also has some rights, and that those rights are couched in the law and in nonviolent change, and they too require respect. So this then is the substance of what I would toss out for your consideration as we try to come to grips with how to deal with speed of change, the complexity of issues, without the ease and the convenience of being able to separate right from wrong and truth from falsehood, quite as simply as we found it possible to do in the good old days.
Question and answer session following Senator McGee's formal remarks is found on the reverse side of this tape.
Now, the senator's time is very limited, and he has graciously volunteered to monitor his own question and answer session so as to make the best use of the time. I ask you, I plead with you, I beg you to please keep your questions short so we can work in as many questions as we can. Senator McGee.
Who has the first question?
Yes, sir.
Right here.
To what extent is the Vietnam War responsible for our campus disturbance?
Yes. The question is, to what extent is the war in Vietnam responsible for our campus disturbances? I think that it is intertwined so deeply that you can't separate it. I would like to think that it's not the only reason for the campus disturbances, that if you settle the war in Vietnam, that the campus would go back to sleep again. I'm afraid that there may be more to that than meets the eye. You see what I'm getting at, that I think that the sign of life on the campus is one of the refreshing things of our time, in contrast to the post-World War II campus generation, where the fellows that came back then were trying to make up for lost time, and they didn't have time to entertain a radical idea and explore it. So I would hope that there is much more to the campus protest movement than just the Vietnam War, but I'm afraid that that's a predominant factor and that those who have legitimate causes to protest on campus would lose a great deal of their support and their following if the issue was settled in Vietnam by tomorrow morning. Yes, sir.
After all, I guess the question is, how can a senator be open-minded about every other issue but Senator Senior, and why doesn't the House on American un-American activity investigating the seniority division to find out maybe it might be un-American?
Yeah. All right, very good. Very fair question. With a very sharp barb. How can a senator be so open-minded on most things and so closed on the seniority system? Let me give you a very candid answer on that. Very frankly, we've sat with political scientists many and many a night, exploring the options, the alternatives in terms of your committee takeovers, in terms of your infrastructure. And so far, the great scholars of politics have flunked the test. In the Senate, we've made some significant changes, let me inject, on seniority. In the House, they haven't taken these steps yet. We've done two things. First, when my class arrived in 58, the majority leader of the Senate, LBJ, decreed that every new freshman senator was to get one major committee. That nearly bombed the rest of the Senate out of existence. That's the only way Gale McGee got on the Appropriations Committee, the first day he was there. The only time it had ever happened in history. That gave me a reason for being, and I worked harder, and I was dedicated to doing my work in the Senate because I had a responsibility. I didn't have to survive for the first decade on minor committees. Republican side didn't make that effort in that direction until about 1962, whenever Dirksen finally made some gestures in that direction. Meanwhile, guys like Cliff Case and Jack Javits had been languishing in obscurity for a good many years. But there's a conscious effort in the Senate now to give a brand new senator one major committee. That's change number one. Change number two, we further have established the procedure in the Senate that no chairman of a committee can himself kill a bill or refuse to let it out of his committee. If a majority of his committee wants that bill out, the chairman steps aside and the next ranking senator in favor of the thing takes over. He becomes the floor manager for the bill so it gets a fair shake. Now, those are two very important changes in seniority. In the House still languishes amid the morass of the old seniority system. The House committees are so large because you have so many members of the House that it's possible for one or two guys to rule the roost. And they do. This needs to be done very, very desperately in the House. But again, a senator always knows more how to clean up the House than he does about cleaning up his own branch. But that briefly is the present circumstance in regard to seniority. You could put these committee chairmanships and your place on a committee on a popularity basis. But I think then you would lend yourself to the former movie star category. And you'd put them as chairman of the committee, or somebody that did you a lot of favors and scratched your back, you'd make him the chairman. I think given all the other alternatives there are, that on the whole, you're probably your most experienced or your most deeply involved person ultimately gets to the headship of that particular committee, whichever one it may be. It's the exceptions that make the headlines and that we get upset about, but they're really exceptions. Most of the system works surprisingly well in that regard because it provides for a calculated, predictable, and orderly change without attracting to that spot the incompetent. Thank you. Let's see, over here. Yeah.
Just to add one more thing to that, isn't the real problem with seniority, the fact that the men keep coming back, term after term?
The question is, isn't the real problem of seniority the fact that the men keep coming back? I guess not to be corny, they're... I don't see any objection to coming back if you have an election and you're not self-anointed in the process. But yes, they keep coming back and thus build up seniority in many cases.
And in the case of the House, though, practically all congressional districts are one-party districts.
So many of the House districts are one-party districts. That's why I think one of the healthiest things that can happen, and the sooner that it can happen, the better, is that the Republican Party put down real roots in the South. I think that's desperately important. I think that, and I think as a Democrat, I'm entitled to say that. But I believe it would be, I hasten to add, I could think of some other places in the United States where I wish they would revive the Democratic Party and put it back in shape too. But yes, but more and more we're getting the broad base of the two parties spread more equitably, and I think this is all to the good. Yes. Do I support the committee to reduce the vote to 18? Indeed, I do. I think this is long overdue. The one objection that I have to the arguments that is used by the 18-year-olds and others, that if you're old enough to carry a gun, you're old enough to vote, I think that's phony. I think you've got a real reason to vote. Don't blame it on the guns. You've got a right as a participating, educated citizen to be involved in governing. And I think that's the basis on which it ought to be put. Yes.
I know
that
you're not right as
question, let's see, I want to make sure I get the point of your question now. I talked about the new left and the old right as they spread around the circle of political thought, meeting on the backside, achieving the same things through different means. Where would I put in all this the The old McCarthyism. You mean McCarthy the bad now? Yeah. Well, but I mean, I want to make sure our McCarthys were straight. Yeah. I contribute the emergence of the rightists of post-World War II to the new affluence that burst out all over once the war in Europe and Asia was terminated. That is, you had this very sharp rise in the standard of living, in consumer luxury goods, in everything. The result is more and more people began to become more and more human in the negative sense, namely selfish. And the extreme right is premised upon the assumption that the Lord has selected the extreme few for his blessing and insights. And this is where the fundamentalists prosper, and this is where the McCarthyites derive their following. People who finally acquired were afraid they were going to lose it, because of the changing times and the speed at which change was surrounding us. I think you found some evidence of this in the labor movement in the last election for a while. This was the appeal of George Wallace. It wasn't his political philosophy per se. It was the fact that here you found many blue-collar workers who now owned their own $20,000 home, and they had a car for the first time. They owned it, or they were making payments at least. And they saw in the race question disturbing elements that would affect their real estate values. And they became scared and they became conservative. And I think that this was one of the chief motivations behind the Wallace appeal in parts of the country where he should have had no appeal at all. Do I get at your question at all? Oh, no, the old right. I referred to it as the old right and the new left. I thought I intended to, at least. Let me adjust it to that. The old rightists simply are having a new day in court because of the extremists of the new left. No, they've never disappeared. They've always been there, and they never went away. Those who thought that with the defeat of Barry Goldwater, the extremists of the far right were done in are just plain off base. Barry Goldwater wasn't one of them. But he surfaced them, and they thought through him they were going to get in and take over. And believe me, they're an unhappy crowd today because they thought they won in November. And now they're a pretty bitter group. They're discovering that what a man says when he's running for office is quite different than what he does when he has to take the consequences as president. Clear at the back. Clear at the back. The question, if I understand it correctly, is that while I talked rather in detail about student protests and the campus issue of dissent and protest, that really isn't a translatable power factor for the reason that they aren't making the laws and many of them don't vote. Most of them probably don't vote. Therefore, is there in the government the same kind of ferment somewhere that's going on, the same challenges being raised, the same doubts being entertained? And the answer to that is yes, that you don't find them as sharply drawn for one reason. There's a difference between Gail McGee as a professor of history at Wyoming solving the problems of the world and Gail McGee as a United States Senator. I discovered that a lot of the solutions that I had in class didn't happen to stand up very well. What I'm saying is that when you have to take the consequences, there a good bit of the edge is taken off, not because someone loses his guts, But because he discovers that somebody else had a point of view that was pretty good, too. And that here's something else I didn't know about that ought to be taken into balance and weighed as you arrive at a solution. And take your illustration, let's say, of the attitude toward Latin America in general. We have some real blind spots in terms of economic ties, in terms of dealing with dictators and this sort of thing. But it's a matter of trying to move as rapidly as you can move without becoming the innovators of internal collapse or change in a violent sense in a given country. I think that's none of our business. I think one of the paradoxes of the moment we find even now, if I can use the illustration, and that is that those same voices exactly that say we have no business meddling in the internal affairs of Vietnam want to know from me why we don't go in and clean them out in the Union of South Africa and get Rhodesia straightened out in a hurry. You see, you can't play it both ways. You got to have a basic, fundamental approach to this. And that paradox, I think, is pretty much to the point that once you inject all of the factors of concern and interest that belong in reaching a decision, it sometimes is far more complex than, as I sketched it in my lectures in class, which made it very simple so you could make a decision. And I think this is the problem that distinguishes the decision-making at the governmental level in contrast to the opinion-making at the non-governmental level. I think there's quite a difference. But I do believe it requires from the constituency a greater tolerance for the right to make a decision in your best judgment. I think this is important. And sometimes it's not present. Yes, right here.
Can you tell us why does the Congress
use a different standard of ethics for the executive branch of government, for example, regarding the revelation of financing, holding, and earning? Can they do for themselves? And what should be done about it? Yes. Question is, why does the Congress use a different set of standards for financial dealings with the let's say with the executive branch, than the executive branch does. You should have added, or than the private sector does. That the Congress is several notches above the private sector on revealing financial dealings. That the private sector is the only one that keeps secrets. Now we demand, as a public, a double standard. That's where the double standard is. It's not in the government. The double standard is that the mistakes of a corporation never become a public scandal. They're buried in the vote of the board of directors. You may throw out the chairman or make him the ex-chairman or something like that, but the mistakes do not become public property. The mistakes that a congressman makes or that a secretary of the cabinet makes are a matter of public property very quickly and become a scandal. Therefore, I think we have to make some allowance for that double standard. Between the executive and the Congress, the Senate last year passed the new disclosure bill. The House is still sitting on it. We reorganized the whole procedure in the Senate and for the House too, but they were less than enthused about some of the things that we passed, that we enacted on our side. I personally think that due to the very nature of public service in these days, that we have to accept the double standard, not between the Congress and the executive, but between the private businessman and the public official. And that therefore, a public man ought to be expected to make his full disclosures. I think it's a little unfair, but I think nonetheless, it's a part of the sophistication of the times that has brought us to that level. So I don't make an apology for it. I think we ought to bring about that change. We tried in the Senate, but again, we always blame everything on the House. One more question here, yes.
Senator McGee, sir, concerning the Black Revolution and its quest for total first-class citizenship, and blacks have tried all types of nonviolent methods from sit-ins to marches on Washington. Could you suggest an alternative to violence? Do you see an alternative to violence in acquiring first-class citizenship?
Yeah. The question is, in regard to the Black Revolution in this country, and its quest for first-class citizenship, as you put it, do I see any alternative to violence for their achieving it? I think I do, sir. First of all, I wouldn't call it the Black Revolution. And I think the sooner we quit talking about blacks and orientals and yellows and browns and talk about people, that we're going to truly become the melting pot. In other words, I think too much of the time, if I may say so very candidly, we have tended to let the conspicuous, visual fact of race become the alibi or the excuse when there is a very deep reason for the change, and that is what you call first-class citizenship. And it has not alone to do with the color of the skin. There are many others that are in an equally desperate plight, like the poor whites in the South, as to use another cliche that we employ, like the residents of the ghetto of many other kinds of racial extraction. And that therefore, the moment we can get away from the black this or the black that, I think we've made one step. The second is that I think we're consciously moving and have moved, making very steady headway. I think for my likes, it has been much too slow. I wish they let McGee run the country. We could do this a lot more wisely, but the trouble of it is there are others who have other ideas about it too. And we're a part of that social structure. And that you've got to move within your social structure. And we're doing it. And we're making that headway. I remember when I met with a group of students in Ghana, in Accra, capital of Ghana in Africa. And they confronted me as a senator of the United States about what we were doing about, as they said, the black man in America. I tried to say we were doing a great deal, not as much as McGee would do, but we're moving, and here's all the great changes we've scored. And they said, that's a bunch of nonsense, and they produced a picture. They showed me a picture of a Negro hanging by the neck. In fact, they ran it on the front page of their campus newspaper in honor of my arrival. They wanted me to explain it. And how do you account for that? Well, I identified the picture with a little help. It was taken from a Louisiana newspaper in 1934. And this was only just a few years ago when I was there in Ghana. And so I pointed out this lapse in time, and that in that interval of time, there have been great strides, but the failures, which we're beginning to compensate for now in political mechanistic terms, we have at last begun to address ourselves to in terms of economics and of social posture in a community, so that there's no discrimination on color. Now this will continue to be violated, as it's continuously violated on the part of those who are of Jewish extraction. This has been going on a long time, but we're making great headway. And it has to be done, it seems to me, within the structure. Otherwise, the violent confrontation, if I may inject, of the last year in Washington or in Detroit, the year before, the summer before, in Chicago, as far as our being able to move meaningfully on this, has set us back at least 10 years, in my judgment, in the Congress. You have a lot of delicate people who never were convinced in the first place, but they were grudgingly willing to go along to give it a chance. And frankly, we were clobbered. So I would finally add this last footnote to it, and that is that even the militancy of the movement on campus to get the black studies programs going, I think this is tremendous. I think that's great. I just think we have to make very sure that these black studies programs are university programs and not black programs. That these are programs in the tradition of higher education and not programs in the tradition of racism. I met with a group of Negro students at Creighton University last week, and we were talking about this question. And one of them said to me, well, we've got to have this black program taught only by blacks, administered by blacks, and participated in only by blacks. And I pleaded with him to think it out otherwise. Because all you're doing then is achieving the other side of the same coin that George Wallace is on. You're segregating. And the name of what we happen to stand for, I think, is genuinely the melting pot. And I just don't like to see our sharpening and drawing of these lines. And I would, a great many of the Negroes that I know in and around Washington there are very sensitive even about this point. That is, they would rather be known as a person, be judged as a man, rather than be singled out as a black and pampered as a black. We just had in front of us, before one of my committees the other day on civil service, a very attractive young Negro from California to be appointed as the new member of the Civil Service Commission. I'm not sure it did the cause a great deal of good. He made it very clear that he never had belonged to any Negro organization, that he was opposed to the NAACP, that he was opposed to nearly every responsible Negro group that had taken root in this country, that he had made his way in other reasons. He had courted the John Birch Society, and they'd made a great hero out of him because they needed one black man to prove that they were liberal. And it was open to question, you see. So only because of the color of his skin did this happen to him. And I say that's wrong to use that either way. I think it's important that we do these things not because the man's black, but because it happens to be right to treat people as people and not as racists of any direction.
Did he get the job?
He got the temporary approval to get the chance to prove himself, and we hope he rises to it. And I hope he makes it. Thank you very much, Senator McGee.